this week on Life and Faith.
On the one hand, we feel this impulsion to tell our story, to share our story, to bear witness of the mystery that is us and to give it away. And that itself is a deeply risky venture because it makes us so vulnerable. And yet that's also what we respond to when somebody shares their story with me.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. It just gets their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker, nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
And we've been thinking a lot about the idea of memoir, of biography, and what it means to tell your life story.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this ever since I saw an episode of The Good Place, which is on Netflix. It's a comedy about the afterlife. And you've got these two characters, Eleanor and Chidi. They've met in the afterlife and they've fallen in love. Mm-hmm. But in the course of living in the afterlife, they come across this room, just go with me here, where you can print out your life story.
Right? Yeah.
But you haven't been the one to write it, is the thing. So she instantly freaks out because she doesn't want Chidi to learn who she really is, because she's worried that if he does, then he won't want to spend eternity with her. But then she eventually decides that maybe he should read it. Like, her thinking is kind of like, let the buyer beware. And then this is what happens.
I'm seeing your whole life all laid out like this. It's remarkable.
Okay, so you still love me, blah, blah, blah. Then what's wrong?
I'm not good enough for you. I mean, look at my file. It is 1/10 as long as yours because I did nothing with my life.
Yeah, we're very different, but we already knew that. Why are you freaking out? You're cool, confident, cheaty now, remember?
I am confident about my feelings for you. I am also confident that I am a damn drip, and you deserve to be with someone who's not.
That's Eleanor and Chidi from The Good Place. Now, what's really funny, Simon, is that no one questions this book's existence. So Eleanor didn't write it. Someone else has actually written it. And the assumption is that this book is going to tell the full truth about someone and nothing but the truth in some way. So you can understand why Eleanor and Chidi both flip out. Like, it's quite horrifying, really.
It is. That's pretty unnerving. There's a few years in my 20s I'd rather not dwell on, Justine. But it makes sense then that we'd want control over our own stories. I was reading recently a New York Times article which was on memoir, and there was this line that said, all memoirs are lies, even those that tell the truth. You know, there's this idea that in trying to even tell your own story, even when you're trying to tell it accurately, the limitations you have on that, the biases you have, are really going to make it kind of it's going to be fiction to some degree. And it reminded me of someone I know, it's a friend of mine, who used to tell this story of his family and him visiting a famous author when he was a child. But he mentioned it one day in the presence of his mum, and his mum said, hey, you know, you didn't do that. You weren't there at all. And he's like, what? What are you talking about? And what had happened in his family was that the story had been told so many times that it had lodged in his memory as something that he'd done. When in fact, he wasn't there. So he wasn't deliberately being deceptive. He believed he was there. But it was a sort of a scary indication of how unreliable our memories can be.
Well, I also freak out when I go on holidays and I take photos. And then in some ways, I forget a lot about what happened. But I only remember because I have the photo.
Yeah, right. So we have this impulse. We want to tell our stories. It's a very strong instinct that we have. But we are asking today, how reliable are we? As we do that, I'm actually reading right now Clive James' Unreliable Memoirs.
So he claims that from the, from right, the title, right?
Straight up with that. And I recently read Tobias Wolff's book about his childhood called This Boy's Life. And it's a great book. But it was interesting to me that this character, if you like, he's telling his story, wasn't all that likable. And then I read that Wolf himself thinks that he might have been a bit harsh on his younger self when he wrote it, because there's different ways you can tell that story, right? And I suspect we have a tendency as we tell our stories, either to other people or even to ourselves, that we're either overly positive, embellishing everything, or maybe overly negative.
Yeah, and I guess that just applies to how we remember ourselves, right? I mean, that doesn't even take into account how we remember other people. I remember Natasha, also familiar to Life and Faith people, surely. Natasha did an interview with actress Anna McGann, who wrote this very raw, intimate memoir about her relationships, including her romantic relationships. And it was her intention to write this completely uncensored version of her own story that told the whole truth as she saw it. But as she worked towards her final draft, her editors encouraged her to approach the people that she'd written about in order to gain their consent for being in this book.
To not be sued.
No, that's right. Because obviously her account of them makes them as vulnerable as she in telling her own story. So have a listen to what she says happened next.
Then came the process of sending different chapters to people that had been written about, and it was fascinating. I had expectations, I suppose, on this is how this person will respond. I know this person. I know what we went through. I know the way I've written about this person. They're going to hate it, or, you know, they'll be fine. They don't really care one way or another. And the reactions were very unpredictable. And so some people very understandably responded with a great amount of fear. Not so much anger, but just, I, you know, this still hurts for me. This can't be published. I don't want to be written about. Or I don't remember this the same way that you remembered this. And that was challenging in many ways, but a real process for me was releasing it, holding these stories very loosely and going, okay, some of these aren't going to make it in, and I'm actually going to allow this to be an organic editing process. And if it's not meant to be in, even if I love it, kill the darlings, let it go. And so some, like, I just charged myself with that if they don't want it published, I will not push this. And so I let quite a few chapters go in that process. And also there are a few that I found that I didn't have the courage to contact the person I'd written about. And so let the chapter go for that reason. It just hurt me too much. But then there were these extraordinary circumstances, some of which eventually didn't even make it in for other reasons, but people that I was deeply afraid of contacting but did, who read it and came back to me and actually said, this reveals so much to me that I didn't realize about this circumstance and or about you or about us, and it reconciled the relationship in a way that I could never have seen had I not written it down. And so that was incredibly healing in many ways as well, because you all of a sudden have a dialogue with somebody from your past that you never thought you'd open that door into again.
That's Anna McGann talking about the process of contacting people she'd written about in her book Metanoia, a memoir of a body born again. Now, that whole chunk that you just heard didn't actually make it into the final edit of our aired episode with Anna, but I'm so glad we got the chance to include it because it really exposes how fraught and maybe unreliable our memories are and the different perceptions people can have about the same event. So in this case, you know, what does it actually mean to tell the truth, the whole truth? Does that even exist?
Indeed. And as we were thinking about this, Justin, I recently caught up with James K.A. Smith. He's a professor of philosophy at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he's the author of numerous books. The latest of these is On the Road with St. Augustine, A Real World Spirituality for Restless Hearts. Now, in this book, Smith suggests, that modern people, used to chasing fulfillment in ambition, romantic love, adventure, and so on, might have a lot more in common with Augustine, this 4th century bishop, than they might expect. Especially considering this impulse that we're talking about today to tell our stories. And arguably, it was Augustine's confessions that kicked off that whole genre. So I talked to Jamie Smith. He's in Michigan. We're on Zoom, so the audio quality might not be all that we'd hoped for, but I think he more than makes up for it. I asked Jamie Smith about the strong impulse to tell our stories and what he thinks is behind that.
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which we want to be known, and there's a deep, I think, human impulse to be known, and that requires of us sharing ourselves, giving ourselves away in a sense. And I think that might partly explain why there's something about just bearing witness to who we are that we're sort of wired to do.
Yes. And I'm interested in this idea that we can never kind of accurately give an account of our lives, especially when you think of the way memory is so unreliable.
It's interesting to see how much, even in contemporary fiction and even contemporary creative nonfiction, this challenge of reliability and unreliability is sort of enacted and performed. And it's interesting, as somebody, you know, as a philosopher and theologian in the Christian tradition, it's intriguing to me how someone like Augustine actually is very attuned to a self-suspicion in this regard. Do you know what I mean? In other words, his faith doesn't translate into any sort of confidence that he knows himself. Quite to the contrary, it's almost like you look inside and you realize that you are this foreign territory. On the one hand, we feel this impulsion to tell our story, to share our story, to bear witness of the mystery that is us and to give it away. And that itself is a deeply risky venture because it makes us so vulnerable. And yet that's also what we respond to when somebody shares their story with me, right? There's something compelling and it draws us in, and we almost want to imitate this venture of vulnerability. And that's what I see in Augustine. And it's so interesting to imagine that this is such an ancient human impulse.
Is Augustine only for believers these days?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's interesting to me how Augustine actually doesn't presume that his readers already agree with him. Right. He doesn't presume that his readers already share his faith. In a sense, he's laying out his story and hoping that all kinds of people who don't agree with him are listening and considering. And it's interesting then that he's not trying to argue somebody to agreement. He's really just laying himself bare and wondering if that isn't a template for people to start to understand themselves.
Now, does Augustine misremember his own failings? I remember reading some of this and thinking, is he talking up his own badness? It didn't seem that terrible to me when you read it, but he has this sort of deep sense of his own inadequacies and failures.
Yeah, he's also, I mean, he's trained as an ancient rhetor and writer, and he knows how to make symbol work. Right. So when he tells you this narrative about stealing a pear, you're like, come on, man, like give yourself a break. Yep. But you realize that for him, this is actually a mythic. It's an episode of mythic proportions for his identity. What's interesting to me is Augustine is also quite unique as a writer in that at the end of his life, he actually reviewed all of his own works and laid out all the places that he was mistaken. It's a work called The Retractions or The Reconsiderations. And that includes his confession. So he goes back and he says, yeah, you know what? I was wrong about this. I got this, I misremembered. I didn't understand. And that itself is an interesting act of humility on his part, I think, to recognize the limits of his own reliability as a rememberer of his past. Not something that is as common today, it seems to me.
No.
And you know, Augustine, he's narrating his life as, you know, a 40-something. And imagine if he did it as a 70-something or a 30-something. It would be an entirely different story because we are not snapshots. We are moving pictures. And Augustine would also say there's a sense in which his story, as he entrusts it, is taken up in a bigger story. So in a way, one of the reasons why it's not just a memoir is because his identity comes from sort of embedding his story in a wider story. And I would suggest that actually every memoir is doing that. Even if it's not aligning itself with some sort of, you know, grand myth, I do think every memoir is an exercise in trying to make sense of my story because I find some identity in a larger story. And it seems to me that there's always almost an element of faith in that, right? We're entrusting ourselves to some narrative.
Yes, and one of your points is that Augustine is trying to kind of turn this category of, you know, memoir, autobiography, us sort of almost inside out, in the sense that he has this idea of the story being given to him rather than being just a creation of the self.
There's a really remarkable dynamic going on in the Confessions where he's very conscious that he is making something here, right? Like, he's a writer, he's a creator, there's something inventive, but it's a kind of invention that is at the same time a reception. There's a giftedness to what he's been given. And if that sounds odd to us, or if that sounds like conformity, I would just caution that I think, you know, all of our hunger for an identity today, we often, I think, say, you know, what does it mean to have an identity? I would say all of us receive that identity from some other or others or some community, something outside of ourselves. And in many ways, the quest for identity, even the sort of passion that animates identity politics, it seems to me, is itself an expression of the fact that we want to receive an identity from some wider community, story, whatever it might be. So in that sense, Augustine is enacting and performing something that should sound familiar to us in a way.
This is Life and Faith from CPX, and we're talking about biography and what it means to tell your story, and what it might mean to receive our story from another. Now, Justin, you wrote about this recently when you read Lisa Tadeo's book, Three Women. This was an interesting book by the sound of it.
Yes, it was wonderful. So she is this journalist who spent almost a decade living near these three women. She even moved cities to be near them. And she basically got them to tell her about their love lives. And she recounts all of their stories in, some might say, excruciating detail, but right. It's very raw, very revealing, very explicit, very kind of intimate, very, very, you know, it's fascinating reading. We're used to reading fiction and understanding implicitly that the author of this fictional book knows their characters inside and out, okay? But we're not used to that when it comes to nonfiction. And so the idea that you could get to know someone to that degree and then write their stories down as if they were a character that you'd made up, like, it's extraordinary that what she's actually done.
Yeah, and thinking of what we've been talking about here in terms of sometimes the unreliability of ourselves even telling our stories, that would seem especially important in a book like this one.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not clear to me, and I haven't been able to find anywhere online any information about what the subjects, the three women, how they've received her retelling of their tale.
They're
right?
Still talking.
Yeah, I mean, I think presumably they would have endorsed it, otherwise she wouldn't have done this, because that was her. Yeah. Yeah, that was her whole intent. But that's also why when I wrote about this for ABC, I included a reflection on this fictional book. This is very clearly fiction. It's C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces. And he's retelling the Greek myth of Cupid and Psyche. But the bulk of C.S. Lewis's book is the main character who's sort of claiming that she's been unjustly treated by the gods. And so she's writing this complaint in some ways to tell the whole truth as she sees it as to why they've treated her badly. But it's really interesting because at one point of the story, she gets the chance to kind of to sort of deliver her speech, which is supposed to be her grand moment where she feels justified. And yet what actually happens is that it's like she gets to hear herself for the first time. She hears her real voice and she sees the depths of her self-deception. And she realizes through this that it's only that through the gods' intervention that she can actually come to know herself. So there's this quote that I want to read because it really captures this. It says, "When the time comes to you at which you will be forced at last to utter the speech which has lain at the center of your soul for years, you'll not talk about the joy of words." So she's finally had the chance to sort of like lay it all down, but she's like, oh gosh.
Coming back at her.
Yeah, that's right. She says, "I saw well why the gods do not speak to us openly, nor let us answer. Till that word can be dug out of us, why should they hear the babble that we think we mean? How can they meet us face to face till we have faces? Of course, that's where the title of the book comes. But that idea, till that word can be dug out of us, that's incredible. It's like, you know, it suggests we are a mystery even to ourselves, and that we need someone else to hold a mirror up to us to actually show us who we are.
We've been talking about telling our stories, but all of this, of course, is connected closely to the topic of personal identity. And it really brought to mind an interview I did a few years ago with Brian Rosner. Brian's a fellow of CPX. He's the head of a theological college in Melbourne. And he wrote a book called Known by God. Now, this book, interestingly, was sparked by a time of deep personal crisis. Here's Brian.
Back in the mid-90s, I was living in Scotland and teaching at the University of Aberdeen and was married with three children. And my wife left me and I was on my own with the kids for several years, ended up moving back to Australia and took a job as a school teacher. So some big parts of my life changed quite dramatically and from my point of view, quite unexpectedly. And that, I think, drove down into the core of my being, had me asking questions that I didn't think I'd ever be asking. And the most basic one is, who am I then? If the story of my life has taken such a dramatic turn and the ways in which I've defined myself in the past have now changed fully, who am I? That was a question I came to.
Did you feel like a lot of the things that had been foundational to you had been kind of ripped away?
Yes, and I remember one incident in Scotland. I was sitting in the car waiting for the engine to warm up to demist the windscreen, and I looked up at the rear view mirror and adjusted and looked and wondered who's that. There's a psychological term for that. It's just an emotional state, dissociation. So it got pretty bad. What settled me was the way in which I, even if I didn't know who I was, my closest friends reflected back to me my identity and reassured me, if you like. So Peter and Sheena had me over for meals. Richard took me for walks. And a good friend, Frank, rang me every Sunday night. And then in an even more profound sense, I came back to the Bible as a Bible scholar. And I noticed a theme that is largely hidden, namely this idea of being known by God, that being known by God gives us a secure and stable identity. So my life is hidden with Christ in God. That idea became very important for me. It didn't have me jumping out of bed whistling a happy tune, but I think it helped me in the sense that the pessimism that might have engulfed me was doused and I was able to carry on.
That's Brian Rosner, author of Known by God, talking about how others knew him even at a difficult time in his life where he felt like he didn't know himself anymore. And it's such a powerful, instantly recognisable idea that if you think of the way parents narrate the memories of their children to their children, I had this experience just the other night. We were sitting around after dinner and somehow we got into talking about the kids when they were little. My kids are sort of mid-teens, older teens. And it was really interesting to watch the way they were so fascinated to hear the stories of them as toddlers and, you know, young kids, you know, long before they can remember anything. And they loved hearing it. I mean, have you had this experience, Justin?
Definitely. I mean, I do this with my kids already. They're only 4 and 5. But there's this smile that comes over their face when I'm starting to remember their younger selves to them. And the smile, I think, just really captures how they understand, even if they can't verbalize this or articulate this, but they understand implicitly that they were known and loved even before they actually could have a sense of what that even means.
There's something really, I think, precious and enticing about that idea. So let's have James K.A. Smith and his reflections on St. Augustine have the last word on this. And how important is to Augustine the concept of being known by God? That becomes a thing for him, doesn't it, by the end?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just Augustine's own experience that not until he is found in one who is infinite can he make sense of the infinite longing of his finite heart, if that's a fair way to put it. In other words, he discovers something about himself. Maybe we could put it this way. He discovers something about himself that is insatiable. Yep. And instead of running away from that or squelching that or trying to repress that, what he finally realizes is that the insatiability of his longing is actually an imprint of the infinity of the one who made him. And it's finally then the synergy between those two things where he realizes that in giving himself away from God, actually what he gets back is the fullness of being human.
Yes. And then if you think of confessions perhaps as a prayer to God, a prayer that's kind of desiring and recognizing that he's fully known by God, might it be that the ultimate audience to whom all of our selves, all of our stories are addressed is in fact, in some mysterious way, God? Is that kind of what might be part of our desire there?
Yeah, and I think it might, there could be a sense in which our compulsion to give ourselves away in a story, in a memoir, will actually only ever fully find its hope when we are heard by that audience, right? When we have a sense that we have been seen and known by that audience. Like you could sell 100,000 copies of your memoir and be on the New York Times bestseller list, and yet you could still feel unknown by the one that you are most needing and longing to be known by. And I think living into that, and that will sound puzzling and maybe even concocted for some, unless you've experienced the success of actually having a bunch of people hear your story and still feeling like you're waiting for somebody to hear it. I think living into that space of experience is exactly what Augustine testifies to.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart with Justine Toe. A special thanks today to James K.A. Smith, speaking to us from Grand Rapids in Michigan. His latest book is On the Road with St. Augustine, A Real World Spirituality for Restless Hearts. We also heard from Anna McGann. She was talking about her book, Metanoia, and also Brian Rosner and his book, Known by God.
If you've been a fan of Life and Faith and liked this conversation, why don't you pass it along? Maybe think of five people you could share this conversation with. And meanwhile, we'll put up links to all the content mentioned in this episode.
Next week.
Your work is often, a lot of us take it for granted. I mean, situations like now when we're being sent home, suddenly that's right in front of us. But for the unemployment rate, the UN says globally is 80% for people who are autistic. Yeah. A lot of these people we meet are 9-10 years unemployed. And for most of us who have gone from job to job, maybe had stints of where we're job seeking for a few months, it's really hard for us to understand that.